Welcome to the Ecclesia Hollywood podcast.
How fun. And instructive, too. The kids are showing us some things. And what they've ushered in for us by what they've sung and what they've done gets us all into Palm Sunday. Some of you are tempted, like, can I come up and get crayons too? Or... they're being so good about it. Nobody's fighting over the green. So I want us to think together about Palm Sunday. Here it is, Palm Sunday. What was going on? It's one of the more misunderstood holy events of the year. Why do so many churches, like we've been doing and we will do later in the service, why do we wave palm branches? What's that all about? What are we saying? And so in our time in the Word, what we want to make sure is that we're not guilty of what so many people in the first Palm Sunday were guilty of, which is misunderstanding what was really going on and what wasn't going on. So to do that, we had to look at the story ourselves. If you're using that Bible right in front of you, it's page 750. If you're using your own or the app, it's John chapter 12. And I'd invite you to look there with me. We pick up, so many millennia later, we pick up the excitement and the joy and the happiness of Palm Sunday. Palm Sunday was a head-on collision of two trains. Palm Sunday was charged, supercharged, with electricity. In fact, that's even understating it, but let's get into it. And one of the questions I want you to hold in your mind is, as we walk through the story, if you were in the story, which of the different people, which of the different roles would you say, I think that's probably where I would be? Where would you be in this story? Not what role would you want to be in, but which role do you think you probably would be in? In John chapter 11, we have to back up and get a running start into John chapter 12. In John chapter 11, Jesus has done something that has been stunning. It just didn't happen, and that was a dead guy, Lazarus, 3 days dead, entombed, and Jesus calls him out of the grave, and the guy actually walks out alive. People saw him. They actually unwrapped him, very much alive. Just sent a ripple of excitement and expectation through the people who observed it, and it sent a different ripple through the religious leadership of terror. Because Jesus is getting out of hand. And people were flocking to him when he was feeding thousands. People were flocking to him as he was healing diseases. But now when you start raising dead people, you're becoming the complete center of attention. And so people wanted a curiosity. They wanted to see who Jesus was. So he did have that, as Dan was describing, that popularity. And beyond that, people dissatisfied with the political scene, dissatisfied with the economic scene, they're thinking, Jesus is my guy. Jesus is my candidate in 2016 to turn this thing around. All of those things are coming together in like a riverbank that's flooding its banks. In John chapter 11, on the heels of raising Lazarus, let me read for us verse 47 and 48. The chief priests and Pharisees call a meeting. So the ruling religious body meets, an emergency session, because crowds are getting all amped up because Jesus has raised a dead guy. And in verse 47, here's the end of their conversation. What are we accomplishing, they asked. Here is this man performing many signs. If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him. And you might think, well, that's a good thing. And they're thinking it's not, because then the Romans will come and take away both our temple and our nation. They weren't just anti-Jesus. that's too one-dimensional to picture them that way. What they were was preserving the status quo. And the status quo included them being in the driver's seat of control. Yes. But they realized if there's a popular overturning of the government, Rome, that is the military occupying power, isn't going to sit idly by. They're going to come in and crush us. Our lives will get worse. So Jesus is a risk, and they can't afford that severe of a risk. They don't want to bring Rome's soldiers back into the streets to crush what's left of Judaism. And so in verse 53 of chapter 11, it says, from that day on, they plotted to take his life. In fact, verse 57 says, the chief priests and Pharisees, the same guys who've had this conversation about Jesus, is he's not willing to live on a leash, and so we got to get rid of him. And in verse 57, they give orders that anyone who found out where Jesus was should report it so that they might arrest him. So that is getting out, and word is now spreading among people that there is this what's quickly going to culminate in a head-on collision between Jesus and the ruling power. And the word is out that if you know where he is, you need to tell us, because we're going to arrest him. Passover, one of the great Holy Week feasts in the Jewish calendar, if you could afford to, you were expected to be in Jerusalem. Now, what that meant was that the number of people in Jerusalem absolutely explodes during that week. It's just crawling with people. It's jammed. So all of this is coming together at Passover week, a seven-day celebration that ends on the last day with the sacrifice of lambs, each family taking a lamb to acknowledge their own sin and being part of the nation that sins, and then the lambs are killed as a substitute for basically confessing we are guilty and yet this animal is going to take the suffering for us. That's the last day of Passover, seven-day feast. So the rumor mill, the grapevine, all of the conversation surrounding and in Jerusalem is, do you think Jesus will dare show his face, knowing that the word is out on the street, that if you see him, let the religious rulers know so they can arrest him? Is he going to call their bluff? Is it a bluff? Will he show up? Will things really come to a complete head? Will he take them on, or will they grab him? So nobody's really paying attention to Passover except for doing the rituals, because they're all watching the drama unfolding and wondering and speculating and rumoring and chattering with each other, what will Jesus do? And he does the one thing that if you had to think of something, if you wanted to throw gas on the fire, this would be the way to do it. It's the opposite of entering Jerusalem low-key. And we aren't even to Palm Sunday yet. Chapter 12, so I'd invite you to go there with me or watch on the screen. Verse 1, 6 days before the Passover. So at the outset of the week, this holy week of Passover, Jesus comes to Bethany. Now that's just a little bit east of Jerusalem. You can walk from Bethany through the eastern wall into the city of Jerusalem. 6 days before the Passover, Jesus came to Bethany where Lazarus lived, whom Jesus had raised from the dead. You want to light a fire and fuel something. The rumor mill is now reporting that Jesus is at the house of the dead guy he raised. You might as well hang out a sign that says, you want to arrest me? Come and get me. I'm at Lazarus's. The buzz is almost too much to bear for people. And so there he is at the house of the guy who's the epicenter of why the religious power wants to get rid of Jesus. They have a dinner, a woman anoints his feet, and you get to verse 9 of chapter 12. Meanwhile, a large crowd, it's an understatement, it's a swollen high tide of humanity, a large crowd of Jews find out Jesus is at Lazarus's, and so they came not only because of Jesus, but also to see Lazarus. I mean, we haven't seen very many dead guys who've been brought back to life, because Jesus had raised him from the dead. So, verse 10, the chief priests made plans to kill Lazarus also. This is getting serious and seriously ugly. You see why sometimes when we just say Palm Sunday, sweet thing, Hosanna, and all that, there's this subplot going on, which actually is the main plot, that's deadly serious. So the chief priests made plans to kill Lazarus as well because, on account of him, many of the Jews were going over to Jesus and believing in him. Verse 12, here is what you and I typically have as our image of Palm Sunday. Verse 12 and following, I'll read it for us. The next day, the great crowd, so a large crowd has now become a great crowd. It's swelling. Finding out that Jesus was at Lazarus's, finding out that Jesus was on his way from Lazarus's into Jerusalem, they're delirious with expectation. The rumor mill has been, will Jesus show up? And now the answer is yes. And the further conversation is, since the religious power base has the word out to arrest him, if Jesus shows up, is he going to confront them and try to overthrow the government? This might be the coup right now. And then Jesus, not in a subtle way, but in a totally public way, starts heading for Jerusalem. And so the crowds are out of their minds with excitement, and some just with curiosity. But for many of them, they want change. And Jesus represents change, and he's now walking right up the road into Jerusalem. And that's what we typically envision and experience, and the kids acted out for us, is Palm Sunday, the celebration of Jesus entering Jerusalem. But it's all the expectations of people. And the reason that they're greeting him with palm branches, and yes, it's a way of waving hello, it's also a way of acknowledging greatness and showing respect and showing great gratitude that finally our answer has come. And all of that, you throw in Hosanna, which is the Hebrew word for saves. So it's save us, save us. And they twice use the word in John 12, referring to him as a king. Now just let that sink in. You're in a country ruled by a military power, Rome, where the religious Congress, the best I can do as a rough parallel to our government, and they're saying, no, this guy, this is our king. They're clearly saying, change of government, change of who's in charge. We're backing this guy. We're overthrowing everything else. They're out of their minds with excitement. They're intoxicated at the possibilities of what's unfolding, not someday, but this day, this very day. And so they're part of this Palm Sunday celebration. And you know the story, and we acted it out here. So Jesus moving toward Jerusalem, and people are laying blankets out on the road, and they're waving palm branches, and everybody wants to see, and the crowd grows and swells as he moves his way into Jerusalem, to the point where, verse 17 to 19, now the crowd that was with him when he called Lazarus from the tomb and raised him from the dead continued to spread the word. So this is becoming an out-of-control mass movement. Many people, because they had heard Jesus perform this sign, went out to meet him, to the point where, verse 19, the religious leaders say to one another, this is getting us nowhere, the whole world has gone after him. If this is a head-on collision, the religious leadership are saying to themselves, we're losing. It's slipping out of our hands. There's too much popular support he's got. We can't stop this. You go to the next verse, and it's not even just a Jewish event. In Jerusalem are those that are non-Jewish called God-fearers, Greeks and others. The Greeks being the highly educated people of that time, the people with the graduate degrees who read lots of books and liked to delve into philosophy and theology and all these sorts, anything that ends with an OG, they were into it. And so in verse 20, you now have Greeks who were in Jerusalem and they want to find Jesus, no doubt to talk to him about his philosophy and values and perspective on life, to understand how does he make sense of life and the meaning of life, and they want to have a philosophical, they want to pick his brain because they've decided he's got great wisdom and we want to benefit from it. So even the Greeks, so when the religious leaders say the whole world's going after him, it's not just the Jewish world. In the very next verse, the Greeks are coming looking for him too. It's there to be had. In fact, if you read the other gospel accounts, during Passover week, Jesus goes into the temple. If you want to get people looking for political change out of their minds with expectation as their popular, hoped-for leader, just head into the temple. And he turns over the tables. He's all but indicating this is a corrupt regime and it doesn't have credibility. So obviously the next thing he needs to do is just set himself up as the new ruler. And that's why Palm Sunday becomes one of the most misunderstood events in the whole year for all of us. You get to verse 24 and 25. The Greeks come asking. And Jesus' reply is, the hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified. And then he says the strangest thing. With it all there for the taking, rule, power, popular support, and the ability in a short span of a day or two to sweep aside all of the crusty, traditional, status quo, corrupt leadership. Jesus says, very truly, I tell you, unless a kernel of wheat falls to the ground and dies, it remains only a single seed, but if it dies, it produces many seeds. Anyone who loves their life will lose it, while anyone who hates their life in this world will keep it for eternal life. What kind of a response is that to the whole world ready to elect you king? Very strange. Verse 32, he echoes it again. I, when I am lifted up from the earth, will draw all people to myself. He said this to show the kind of death he was going to die. And for those who were paying attention, and nobody really was, they would have remembered, and the gospel writer did later because he put it in there, that at Lazarus' home the night before all of this entry, palm celebration, power grab possibility happened, there was a woman anointing Jesus' feet with expensive perfume, which was used to anoint dead bodies. The theme of death, not tragic death because somebody killed him, but choosing death, when he easily could have chosen power and popularity because it was there, and the religious leadership are back on their heels reeling and about to buckle. And Jesus doesn't seize it. So what's going on there? And as best I can understand it, and I've thought about this passage for a long, long, long time, years and years. If Jesus uses political leverage to place himself in control, he condones political power as a means. And then someone will use political leverage down the road. And he creates a world where politics is what makes it happen. If Jesus gives in to the strong, high-tide desires of the masses, then what he condones is, if enough people are for it, let that carry the day. Even the disciples misunderstand what's going on, so let's get that in there because that's part of the mix too. In a moment, we'll see a bit of what happens in the very next chapter in John 13. It's what you and I would know as the Last Supper or the First Communion, whatever you want to call it, same event. But remember that the other gospel accounts tell us as they were stepping into that Last Supper, the disciples are debating among themselves, who's the greatest? Where did that come from? Well, where it came from was Jesus is entering on Palm Sunday. The masses are ready to install him as king. The religious leadership is on its heels and about to buckle. And if you're one of the faithful, serving disciples of Jesus, it's sort of natural to begin to think about, so what position will I get in the new government? And I may not be the whiz kid in the group, but I'm not motor mouth like Peter, so I think I'm better than him. And at least I'm willing to trust Jesus instead of like Thomas, who says, you know, Thomas the scientist, if I can't verify it and attest to it, I won't believe it. And at least I don't have a some kind of like an eruptive, uncontrolled temper, like the sons of Zebedee who want to call lightning on anybody they don't like. And all of this is going on in the midst of this. You can read about it in the other gospel accounts. As they're heading into the Last Supper, there's a bowl of water and a towel, and the lowest person in the group, it was understood, it was cultural, it wasn't demeaning, the lowest person in the group, the rookie, if you will, in the group, the youngest or the most immature or the most inexperienced or the newest, picked up the bowl and the towel and would wash the feet of all the people entering for the meal because the roads were dirt, and so your feet are dirty and your sandals are open-toed shoes. Now, if the homeowner had enough wealth that they had servants, then a servant would be the one to wash the feet of the guests. But if there's no servant, that's okay, no problem. Then the youngest among us, the newest among us, the lowest in rank, that's your job. Everybody knew that. And yet what happens in John 13 is they're all entering into that home for the Last Supper. The bowl and the towel are there. So clearly the owner, who's allowed them use of the room, hasn't provided a servant, and so that means the lowest of the group, the newest, the newbie, has to wash the feet, and they all walk past the bowl, and no one will do it. So the inner dialogue had to have been, well, I might not be first on the team, but I'm not last, I'm not lowest. In fact, I kind of think you are. So go ahead, and you're like, well, no, I think he is. Well, no, I think she is. So even the disciples are misunderstanding what's going on. The crowds want a change of government. The disciples want position. They want, as one of my friends profoundly put it oh so long ago, Willis said this. He said, we all want what we want when we want it. Did you hear that? We all want what we want when we want it. The crowds want what they want, and they can use Jesus to get it. And the disciples want what they want, and they can use Jesus to get it. And the religious leadership wants what they want, and they have to eliminate Jesus to get it. And some want to use politics, and some want to use popularity, and some just want to use personal persuasion and influence, or competing and criticizing. And in contrast to all that, here's Jesus who isn't pursuing what he wants. He's the only one who is saying, there's so many things I could grab and there's so many things I could do that people want me to do, and instead what I'm going to do is voluntarily die. Stunning when it's all there for the taking. And he walks away. Now, a few things to press home and understand. So when the kids said, well, so Jesus on a horse is how it ought to be, knights and cowboys and, you know, castle soldiers and donkey, that's just a beast of burden. When you came in on a donkey, it was a message of peace instead of a message of confrontation. So Jesus is already sending messages. I'm not here to flex power. And I'm not here to be the answer to your need for getting what you want. And instead, the way for Jesus is the way of dying. Now, it's really hard for us because we're 2,000 years removed and we know Easter's coming, so we know how the rest of the story goes. But appreciate that nobody living in this story knew what the next hour or next day or next week was going to bring. So if you're someone who has believed in Jesus, has followed him, or maybe you're even just part of the crowd and it's like, I want him to do for me what I really need, or maybe you feel threatened by him because he may completely uproot my life. All of those things, what Jesus does is so strange because what he does is he voluntarily loses, if I can use that phrase, which runs counter for us to what we want, and it runs counter to our culture. We don't write many books, we don't make many movies, we don't sing too many songs about people who lost. And yet, the way up is the way down. And the way of following is often the way of letting go. What matters most to me? It's painful. It feels like death. I can remember times in my own life in different ministry situations where, as, and I'll say this humanly because I don't want to sound like, you know, I've got a corner on the wisdom market, but to the, I would tell you flat out, to the best of my hard, long look in the mirror, I was acting with integrity and I was doing the right thing and I was following the Lord and I lost. And the wrong people came out on top. And that was really hard to live with. And then I looked at this, it was almost like Jesus was saying, yeah, that's part of how it goes sometimes. You don't look to lose, but you don't have to win. It doesn't have to go your way. And what Jesus is demonstrating by his life, much more than even his words, is I'm not here to get what I want, I'm here to do what God wants. And what he wants, strangely, is for me to die. And I'm not going to whine about it, I'm going to do it. Just go for a brief moment with me into chapter 13, which takes us into that Last Supper. So Jesus cleansing the temple, the crowds are ecstatic with the expectation he's going to overthrow the government right now and become our king. And instead he walks away from the temple and hangs around Passover week, but he doesn't seize power. And the people are totally confused. In fact, by the end of the week, many of them will be calling for his death because they're so disenchanted. He didn't do what I wanted him to do. And so in chapter 13, he's at what you and I know as the Last Supper with the disciples, and no one will wash the feet of anybody else because nobody's willing to be the low person among the disciples. They're so focused on what's in it for me that Jesus becomes the one to wash the feet of arrogant, judgmental, comparing, competing, criticizing disciples. The night before Jesus is going to die, he's got to live with all of this ugliness among his own crew. Even washing Judas's feet. Whew. Man, that takes a lot. To kneel at the feet of the guy you know has betrayed you. To stare into his eyes as you wash the crap off his feet. And without saying a word, to look at his eyes and send a message that says, I know what you've committed to do. It's not too late to back out. It's not too late to undo it. I love you even when you're knifing me in the back. And then he finishes, and let's look at what Jesus says to them in John 13, verse 14. Now that I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also should wash one another's feet. It's a new way of doing life. The way up is the way down. Not groveling down, but serve others who don't deserve it, because neither do you and me. I've set you an example that you should do as I have done for you. Very truly, I tell you, no servant is greater than his master, nor is a messenger greater than the one who sent him. Now that you know these things, you'll be blessed if you do them. Verse 34 and 35, in the same dinner, after washing their feet, after saying no to power that was there for the taking, saying no to popularity that was clamoring for him, Jesus says, a new command I give you. The way of love, not the way of power, not the way of popularity. It's the way of love. As I have loved you, so you must love one another. By this, everyone will know you're my disciples if you love one another. As I have loved you, how has Jesus loved them? Sacrificial, serving, suffering, even dying. We don't get many scripts that speak about that. So, ushers are going to come and they're going to hand out palms to all of us. Because Palm Sunday isn't just, isn't it cute the kids are waving palms? But we wanted to wait until we had a chance to walk through this passage so that a little later in the service when the worship team is leading us in song, that as we are waving, we understand what we're saying with our palms. Because the crowd didn't understand what they were saying. They were saying, I want what I want. When I want it, and I think you can give it to me, so I'm going to use you. Would you be my king? Because I want what I want. And so in a few moments when we come to the end of preaching and start worshiping through song, let your palm branch say, Lord, I honor you for the way of suffering, sacrificial love I honor you for following God instead of what you want. And in waving your palm, can it be an extension of my life and your life, saying to him, I help me live that way. Help me be one who loves and serves and washes feet rather than one who thinks about winning and getting my way. And you leave the results to God. That's a life of faith. And think about how that translates into the very practicals of our life. As you go to work tomorrow, some of those people that you don't really want to serve them, they're kind of a jerk. They haven't done anything for you. But now you have a new perspective. It's not about do they deserve it. And this applies to all of us. It can apply to a kid. What about the kid that's been mean in the neighborhood or at school? Do you just avoid him and do you talk to other kids and badmouth him? Or do you say, wait, maybe I could serve them in some way? We had that with our own granddaughter. She came home from school one day and rather tearfully told us that some of the kids were mocking and making fun of her physique. Interesting conversation. What do you do with people that are mean to you? Do you just avoid them? Do you cut them off? Do you be mean back? All possibilities. Tell your friends and gossip about them? Pit people against people? Is there a different way to approach them and love them and serve them? And you could still tell them, please stop saying that to me. Or do you cut them off? So this isn't just for adults, it's for people. Kids, people, all of us. What this passage does for me is it brings me to a place of worship, but not just light, happy, Palm Sunday, yippee, but with some gravity to it. Still grateful and still celebrating, and yet very sobered that Jesus chooses the path of suffering and death when he could have chosen power or popularity. Somewhat convicted because maybe you find yourself like me sometimes saying, am I like one of the disciples that's kind of thinking about position and status and where I stack up compared to others? Or am I like the crowd and I'm trying to use Jesus to get what I want? Or am I like the religious leaders and I'm trying to preserve what I got going here and I really don't want to invite God to mess with it. I want to keep controlling what I've got going. Or what one woman understood, the only one on Palm Sunday. This is about death. This is about worshiping Jesus who's willing to die for us. And she fills the room with perfume and nobody got it. She did. And there's a great freedom in saying, my life isn't mine, it's the Lord's, and I trust the Lord who's loved me enough to wash my feet. Frees me to wash other people's feet and to trust God instead of say, it has to go my way. And now Palm Sunday and waving palms and worship takes on more than just happiness. It really means our lives are being lifted up, saying, oh, we honor you for doing what no one else does. Saying no to popularity and power and saying yes to deep sacrificial love for us. And we're saying, you have saved us and we want to be like you. Help us. Greg? Let's pause and pray for a minute, and by the time we're done praying, we'll be ready to worship with palm branches more than waving them. So let's have a moment of quiet, and you can talk to the Lord. How has this revisiting of Palm Sunday spoken to you? What do you need to talk to the Lord about, either in your own life or about attitudes and treatment of other people?
Thanks for listening. To find out more, please visit churchinhollywood.com.